omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University. Now, here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today, we'll be joined by AFGE 14th District National Vice President Dwight Bowman, Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher, and former General Counsel Mark Roth. But first, hear Jason Fornicola's interview with U.S. Election Assistance Commission Commissioner Gracia Hillman.
We've been joined now by Gracia Hillman, the Commissioner of the United States Election Assistance Commission. Commissioner, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're happy to have you. And what I want to start off with is really an overview of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission.
In the scheme of federal government, the Election Assistance Commission is a relatively new agency. It was created in 2002 when Congress passed the Help America Vote Act. We operate as an independent agency, four commissioners, a bipartisan commission, and the commissioners are appointed by the President of the United States. Our principal role is to provide resources, both financial and guidance and guidelines, to the states, to all the states, to improve the process of administering federal elections. That is, the elections that occur for Congress and President of the United States.
So you're improving elections. What do you think needs the most improving?
Well, I think there are two areas that need some attention. One is making sure that correct information gets to the voters. Every state has a number of local jurisdictions, and the local jurisdictions, for the most part, are responsible for voter education. But the secretaries of state play a big role in voter education. So making certain that voters have information, and the Election Assistance Commission is pleased to be able to provide a wealth of information through our website, www.eac.gov, and it tells voters everything they may be curious to know about and provides a link to their state so they can get information about their own state's voting procedures.
Okay. Commissioner, if I were to log on to that website, would I be able to get election results the night of an election?
No, or no? We do not do that. We just provide the upfront information. We want voters to know about provisional voting, so if they go to the polls and are told they're not on the voter registration list, what their right is to be able to cast a ballot. I mean, if we focus on voter registration, this is the time for people to make sure they are, in fact, registered to vote. I hope that all of your listeners voted in 2008. If they did, they should be on the voter registration roll. But states have had budget problems and some have cut back on the number of polling places there are. So voters should make sure they know where to go to vote, particularly people who vote in the evening and may be short on time.
And so they may show up to a place and think that's where they're supposed to vote, and it turns out that they're not.
Right. And in that instance, if there isn't enough time for the person to get to the correct polling place, they are entitled to vote a provisional ballot, which means most often it's a paper ballot, and then the election officials check to make sure the person is properly registered. Now, of course, it gets complicated because every state has a different procedure about when a provisional ballot counts, but that's a right for the voter. The other place that needs attention is election officials, the people who run the elections, need lots of volunteers on election day. And so we encourage people to really consider the opportunities to be poll workers on election day, to be the front line of customer service in the polls, providing assistance to people who come in to vote.
A lot of different places have different ways to cast a ballot. You can do it by pencil and paper, you can do it electronically somehow. Talk about the shift that we're seeing to a more electronic system of voting and implementing it, obviously, effectively and correctly.
Sure. The Help America Vote Act provides a very important thing, and that it requires states to have voting systems that can do two fundamental things. One is to let a voter know that they have committed an error on their ballot. If you have voted for more people than you should have, that ballot should tell you right then and there before you leave that your ballot needs a correction. And that's a right the voter has. And so the systems that are called optical scan, where you mark the ballot and then the ballot is fed through a scanner, or the direct recording electronic machines, which are called the touchscreen machines. If you make a mistake, it will tell you before you leave the poll that you have an opportunity to go back and correct the ballot. the United States government, for the first time since the passage of the Help America Vote Act, now takes the responsibility to not only set standards for the voting systems, but to also accredit the laboratories that test the voting systems, and we certify the voting systems. Now, state compliance is voluntary. States don't have to use the federal certified machines, but it is an assurance to the states and to the voters that these systems have met rigorous standards and that they all have been certified by the federal government as being in compliance with the standards.
Are you finding that states are adopting this new technique and using that more and more?
Yes, and some states have their own testing procedures, but most of them are looking to the federal government certified machines. Now, as most of your listeners will appreciate, in federal government, it takes years to get a brand new procedure put in place. So we are still going through the transition from no federal certification to making sure that all systems are federally certified. And we really are looking to the next generation, systems that may get into the market in 2012 and beyond 2012. For the most part, you're right. We have optical scan machines and the touchscreen machines that voters will have an experience on. What's great about the Help America Vote Act as well is it requires people with disabilities can vote independently and privately, the same as other voters. So the voting systems must accommodate people who have a hearing loss, people who are sight impaired or blind, people with other physical disabilities that would prevent them from casting, say, a straight paper ballot.
What kind of feedback do you get from voters on some of these initiatives and maybe some of the changes that you're making to improve the voter process?
Well, people are confused about the provisional voting process because in some states, if you're in the wrong precinct, your provisional ballot won't count. In some states, as long as you're in the right county, your provisional ballot will count. In some states, it's congressional district. So people are confused about that and sort of wish there was a more standardized procedure. Other people are a little confused about the voter registration process. If you move and fail to notify on your own the election office, you may not be properly registered, and that may interfere with your ability to vote. And so people are wondering why technology can't be used that would allow a larger database of voters. Every state is supposed to have in place today a statewide voter registration database. So if you are in, say, Baltimore, Maryland, and you're registered to vote in Annapolis, the people in Baltimore should be able to access the database to know, yes, you're registered in Annapolis, you've just moved to Baltimore, let's change your address.
And are you finding the compliance level is where it should be on those things?
Yes, I think some of the states are a little behind on the statewide voter registration database. Mm-hmm. It requires a lot of technology and implementing a database that can communicate with local jurisdictions and that can communicate with the Department of Motor Vehicle, because that's where people can register to vote, at the Department of Motor Vehicle when you get your driver's license, and other public service agencies. Anybody going to a public service agency is supposed to be provided the opportunity to register and vote, and that information then gets transmitted to the statewide voter registration database.
If you can, Commissioner, for a minute, talk to me about the importance of encouraging people to exercise their right to vote.
That is such a fundamental part of what makes the United States of America tick. I mean, if you think about elected officials, they're campaigning for their job, and it's the voters who decide who gets that job. And when people don't turn out to vote, they're leaving the decision to a minority of people. When you hear about 10 and 20% voter turnout, it says that 80% of eligible voters decided to not participate. And there are lots of reasons why people don't vote, but the states really are working now to try to minimize the obstacles. We see a lot of early voting where people have up to 2 weeks before Election Day to be able to register and vote. We see people going to what's called central polling locations so that you can vote in a central place and you don't have to get across town if you work in the northwest part of a city and you've got to go all the way to the southeast part of a city. You can register to vote online and you can register to vote through the mail. And so states are working to accommodate that. Some states are going to almost all mail-in ballots so people can just receive their ballot at home, no excuse absentee voting. Fill out your ballot and mail it in. But it is absolutely something that democracy in the United States is made up of.
There's nothing greater.
No,
now,
absolutely.
What do you say to the person who would look at you and say, Commissioner, my vote doesn't count?
Well, there is a blurring of the line between campaign activities and the administration of elections. And while it's something that not everybody thinks a lot about, it is important for people to be able to make the distinction. In campaigns, the name of the game is win. And unfortunately, we've heard some rhetoric that discourages people and makes people think that this process really isn't about my vote. It's about who has more money or who can get on television more. If you look on the other side of the line, it is the election official. That person may be registrar of voters. That person may be the county clerk. That person may be the city clerk or the secretary of state. Those are the people, and many of them are government employees at the county and city and local level. These are people whose full-time job it is to make certain that people not only have the opportunity to be a registered voter, but that the election process is as efficient as it can be. It's all about human beings. Yes, we use machines to vote on, but when you think about it, it is human beings who do all the work surrounding elections. And so those election officials have professional staff. They depend on poll workers, and their focus is on making sure that people have the opportunity to vote. And people shouldn't think that the campaigns run the elections because they don't. But we understand that people do get discouraged by a lot of things that go on in their community.
Sure.
And you would think it would be the reverse response. I'm frustrated. I don't like this. I'm going to get involved.
I'm going to go vote.
Absolutely.
We've obviously established and know how important it is to exercise one's right to vote. Talk about the need for voters to feel comfortable and confident when they go to the polls and feel like the country is protecting them and protecting their right to do this.
Congress took action in 2002 because it recognized that for many years, the federal government has delegated to the states the responsibility to conduct federal elections. Federal elections include voting for President and Vice President of the United States, for members of the United States Senate, and for members of the United States House of Representatives. But the federal government never gave financial resources to the states to help them execute that responsibility. In 2002, Congress stepped up to the plate. It not only required the improvement of the administration of elections, but it also gave substantial financial resources to the states so that states could buy new equipment, could take advantage of technology, could institute a statewide voter registration database, could train poll workers so that the people who work on the polls have sufficient training. And voters should know that the election officials are professional people. They are committed to good customer service. They understand what their job is. People should also know that the Help America Vote Act provides an administrative complaint procedure. If you go to the polls and you incur a problem and you feel that you were not fairly treated or that you should have been able to vote but you couldn't, you can file an administrative complaint and the election official is required to follow up on that.
And so as we come into our last minute here, tell me what's coming up for the midterm elections. Obviously, that's going to be a big time for you. You're going to have a lot going on. What's coming up for the commission then?
Well, every state will be engaged in voting. And so we are encouraging people to serve as poll workers. If there aren't sufficient poll workers, there can't be sufficient customer service, and that leads to long lines, and long lines discourage voters. People should make sure they're registered to vote, and we are encouraging people to know what that is. And we are always keeping our eye out for problems that might incur with the voting systems so that we can see if our standards are accurately addressing the kind of voting systems that we should be using in this country.
Commissioner Gracia Hillman of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, great to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Dwight Bowman, AFGE 14th District National Vice President, and Bill Fletcher, AFGE's Field Services and Education Department Director. Welcome back to Inside Government, gentlemen.
Well, thank you for having us.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
So we got a big rally coming up on Saturday, the One Nation March on Washington, Saturday, October 2nd, at 12 o'clock at the Lincoln Memorial. Tell us a little bit about what's going on at this rally.
This rally is, first of all, it's starting around noon. For AFG members, we're getting together around 10:30 at the Sylvan Center, and then people are heading over towards the Lincoln Memorial, which is where everything is going to convene. This is a march and rally about jobs. This is about economic justice. This is, in some ways, the flip side, an anti-Tea Party type experience, because what this is saying is that we need government, that government needs to be serving the people, that when you're in a great recession like we're in right now, you need to be investing in the future of this country as opposed to focusing on cutting and deficits and further restrictions on government.
Now, I remember the second march on Washington, the first one I was probably not born yet, but the second one, I remember it was very hot. A lot of people were concerned about, I guess, making sure that you got enough food, water, and that kind of stuff going on. For this one, everybody's going to meet, or at least the AFG folks are going to meet at the Sylvan Theater, and that's at the corner of Independence Avenue and 15th Street, Southwest, the Smithsonian Metro. What kinds of things are AFG people going to find as they get to this rally?
Well, one of the things that we're going to do is have water at those tables. We're also going to provide food for the AFGE people who do come. We're going to have flyers and pamphlets, information sheets of all kinds. We're going to have T-shirts, and we're going to have a lot of camaraderie. This is an opportunity for union people to get together and to coalesce, and we haven't done that very much lately. There's a spirit in this nation right now that says that everything is moving towards the right and conservatism. But the reality is this is America, and this is a time for all Americans to come together to recognize that we have a national problem and to work on that problem together. And it is time for us to let the White House know where what our position is and how we feel about things, and not just one segment of the society.
Now, where did this rally start from? Whose idea was it, and what was the background on this?
Well, the rally came out of a few different directions. First, in the early part of 2010, Fred Mason, who's the president of the Maryland DC AFL-CIO, raised the issue of the need for another march on Washington. He was suggesting August 28th, the anniversary of the 1963 march, and he felt that the union should take the lead. Then later, the NAACP and 1199 of the Service Employees International Union out of New York raised the issue again, but they suggested doing something in October 2nd. So that's basically where it came about. And it was this need that was perceived of responding to the depth of this economic crisis, that that we have this situation where, as MVP Bowman was saying, people on the right are suggesting a certain direction, and they are getting the media. Their people are listening to them, but those that are saying that there's a different course that really speaks to the depth of the crisis aren't getting the attention. That's what this rally is going to address.
And one of the issues as we're talking about is jobs. And, of course, we just finished the D.C. election. A lot of concern by both AFG members and members of the community about what's going on in Washington, D.C. and in this area in terms of jobs. MVP Bowman, what can you tell us about sort of the feel of the folks in the area?
Well, first off, the citizens are elated. We've had a good Democratic election, and we have chosen Vincent Gray to be the next mayor. It's our feeling that it's time for a change in Washington, D.C. It would appear that some people believe the government can do a lot with regard to jobs, but the reality is all of us have to work together and to figure out how to overcome the crisis. Public employees, and particularly AFGE, are ready to work with this new administration. We weren't given that opportunity with the past administration, but we're ready to work with this new administration and to offer solutions and to help with the problem.
Now, another issue that's coming up that's a major part of this rally is education. Tell us a little about the focus on education and what the country can do on this issue and how the rally is going to focus on this.
Well, I mean, what's been happening over the last 30 to 40 years is that with cuts in funding to education, the public school system has been weakening. And what has happened is this vicious cycle where the public school system weakens, people that have the ability take the children out of public schools, don't want to pay taxes for it, and things continue to get worse and worse. And what we have to realize is that any advanced civilization needs an advanced educational system. That is, you can't rely on private education when you're talking about the need to educate millions of students and prepare people for the 21st century and the various challenges. So it really means an investment. It means more funds into the schools so that we cut down on class size. The critical thing in any educational system, people know again and again, is class size. When you have fewer students such that teachers can focus, the students are going to get a higher quality education.
I'd like to add to what Bill has just said. There's a lot of scapegoating across the nation, but particularly here in the Washington metropolitan area with regard to the teachers being the fault. And one of the things that we hope to address at this rally is that the teachers are not the fault. We're all in this together, the parents, the teachers, the administration, and the unions. There's always this business about, we can't get rid of good, bad teachers because of the unions. That's simply not true. I have never seen a contract that said that individuals who were not performing their task could not be removed from their positions. And that has never been the position of the union. What we want to see is fairness and equity.
And as this rally's coming together, people are very excited. We know people are coming in from all over the country. Tell us a little about some of the places we know people are coming from. I know there's buses out there, people from Baltimore, Philadelphia, as far as Chicago, I think all up and down the East Coast. Tell us a little about that.
Well, the march organizers concentrated on the radius of 12 hours drive from D.C. That was the focal point in terms of mobilizing for this. But there's going to be marches and rallies held in other parts of this country, some bigger, probably Los Angeles, and I believe Phoenix are planning on big rallies. There's going to be smaller ones in other parts of the country. It's wherever people can gather, build a critical mass, and stand up, and they're going to make that done. So all up and down the East Coast, we're going to have people coming to Washington, D.C. And as you said, I think it's far west is probably Chicago, but more likely it will be closer, probably in the Ohio area.
And MVP Bowman, what are some of the other issues that people are coming? A lot of people have been concerned that, you know, we voted for hope and change, and that's been frustrated by Congress to some extent and getting legislation through moving fast enough. Is this kind of going to be a coming together of people to sort of say this is what we've been trying to do and to vent some frustration as well and maybe move that agenda along?
Absolutely. We have seen a lot of stalemating over the past 18 months. We've seen certain politicians lay blame without offering real solutions. We have been watching this dynamic for some time, and it is time for the union movement to stand up, to speak out, and to, as I said before, offer solutions to the problems, to let the administration and the rest of the country know that they're not alone. The majority of the people in this country want progress. They want change. They want a new dynamic.
Who are some of the other organizations that are part of this?
Well, there's a variety of different organizations. You have the NAACP, is, as I mentioned, that's very active in this. The unions are playing a critical role. They're brought together in this coalition that's known as One Nation Working Together. You have environmental groups that are active, women's groups. So you have the spectrum that's very well represented. The focal point of this rally, just to be very clear, is on jobs and economic justice. There are issues that actually divide us that exist, and you'll see at in the coalition that there will be differences of opinion. But what's remarkable about this is that despite differences, people are saying jobs and economic justice in this moment of a great recession is what brings us together. We need to be there. And in some ways, the big question is, why is this demonstration happening now as opposed to October 2009? Why did it take us this long to begin to mobilize? Because the people on the Hill, the people in the White House, needed to hear our voices.
And is there a frustration also that you hear from our members and the public in general in terms of the hate speech on the far right, on talk radio, that sort of thing, that really, instead of marginalizing certain groups in the society, that we need to come together as one country and move forward, and that's what we thought we were trying to do for the past couple of years?
Absolutely, and I think that there's a lot of fear because of these hate mongers, the birthers who question whether President Obama was actually born in the United States. Those that play on race and gender. I think that there's a lot of concern of the irrationality that's coming out of segments of the political right. So this is one of those moments when people of goodwill are coming together and saying that there is a progressive direction this country can take.
The One Nation March this Saturday, October 2nd at 12 p.m. at the Lincoln Memorial. For AFGE folks, we're gathering at 10:30 at the Sylvan Theater. We're going to pause for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government, but listen to our members, the real people, who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by General Counsel Mark Roth, or retiring General Counsel Mark Roth.
Thank you very much, Ward, and let me just say how proud I am of you as my Assistant General Counsel for Legislation for the wonderful job you've done on this radio show and the great service that this radio show has been for people in government and, in particular, federal employees.
Let's talk about you. 35 years at AFGE. What's it been like?
It's definitely been a wild ride, and it has definitely been such a privilege for a lawyer to find the exact right fit. I basically hate every other type of law but labor law. So to end up in labor law for a union, working for a noble cause, and making a difference in how government operates and in workers' lives has been just an absolute privilege for me, very fulfilling, and believe me, it has been very challenging. I became general counsel in July of 1983 under that great government lover, President Ronald Reagan, and it hasn't been easy, but I think, like I said, it's been very satisfying to me. I've worked under four national presidents, six national secretary treasurers, six women directors, and close to 100 national vice presidents of AFGE. So when I say it's been a wild ride, they've all had strong and unique personalities. But I can say without any equivocation that I don't think I could have had a better job. And I really love this union. It's been a great union. It is a great union. And I think I'm passing the torch at the right time. And to a very wonderful man, David Bohr, the former general counsel of the Flight Attendants Union and former executive director of the Mass Teachers Association. So I think we're going to have a very seamless transition. And this union's in for some battles with the new Congress, and I think it's time for me to pass that torch and that battle on. I think I've left enough blood on the battlefields over the years, but I leave complete and fulfilled about my career. Very proud of it, you know, humble but proud.
And let's talk about some of the beginning. I mean, you didn't come to labor law just sort of falling off a tree. I mean, you and I both share in our family history the letter carriers union, in fact.
My dad was a mailman, and his route was downtown Boston, Boylston Street, and the Back Bay. For those people who are familiar with Boston, they know that that's probably the best route on the planet. He delivered mail to Red Auerbach at the Lenox Hotel, and in her later years, he used to literally pick up Judy Garland and bring her back into her apartment. She moved to the Back Bay when she was going through a lot of difficulties. It was a tremendous time. He would call me up, and at that point, you could get Celtics tickets, Red Sox tickets, right the same day of the game. And we would go in. He had the jazz workshop in Paul's Mall. These are were little places that broke people like Linda Ronstadt, Joni Mitchell. So it was a tremendous time, and following my dad on the route was tremendous. He was, of course, hatched, and I just could never understand why he couldn't get involved in politics. It made no sense to me. He went on strike against the government around 1970, along with the New York area locals. He was a strong, strong national letter carriers union advocate, and did basically hand that off to me, as I've tried to hand off that sense of the good that unions can do to my children.
So what got you, obviously this would have exposed you to unions, but when you got out of law school, what made the decision labor law?
Well, first of all, I had the most wonderful labor law professor in law school, and I loved all the courses. I loved the puzzle of putting it all together, labor and management rights. And my goal coming out of law school, I had done criminal law work as an intern, and poverty law. In criminal law, I was very successful for a firm in Boston, and in one summer alone, I got put back, admitted murderers on technicalities, rapists, and gamblers. So every win to me was like another stab in the heart. So I knew criminal law was not going to cut it. I knew that, you know, working for a law firm was not my cup of tea. The poverty law, I spent most of my time trying to track down my clients and getting them to their hearings. So I knew that really wasn't what I wanted to do. So the balance of making a difference in people's lives in an area that's important and making a difference in good government. These two things struck me. I was very fortunate. I came to D.C. to get an LLM and did get it in labor law at Georgetown Law, and was picked up by AFGE in June of 1976. And again, those dual things, making a difference in working people's lives and making a difference in how government runs, have really been my goals, and I think I've done well at them.
And let's talk about some of the sort of monumental things that have happened along the way. I mean, the Civil Service Reform Act, which everybody takes as something that's always been there. I mean, you were kind of there at the beginning on that. What was that like?
Well, before that, we were under an executive order and could have been wiped out with the stroke of a pen, which I'm sure would have happened if not under Ronald Reagan, under Bush too. So it was really, even though most of it was a codification of the executive order, it was just really a quantum leap in establishing a statutory labor relations program. I do have to say that I've been disappointed that we set it up on a private sector model and it's been so adversarial, because I really don't see the point in the federal government of such adversarial labor relations. I mean, we all want the government to work. We want it to work great. And I think I see the union as a check and balance on bad management and management mistakes. The Civil Service Reform Act really was a wild time. Every case for the next 3 years was a test case. We were in the U.S. Court of Appeals and Supreme Court on a regular basis, and it was a very exciting time.
And what are some of your greatest memories in terms of cases and situations you found yourself in?
Well, I had the first whistleblower protection case under the Civil Service Reform Act, Frazier versus MSPB. And that was the first, and I think only time, the full board heard a case without any previous administrative judge hearing it. I literally was in a courthouse before the three members of the MSPB. And we defined the rights of whistleblowers. So that Frazier case was pretty awesome. A lot of publicity, involved deputy U.S. marshals, discrimination, and just a horrific workplace in Atlanta, Georgia. Went to the Court of Appeals, where the famous Judge Bazelon wrote the decision on appeal. I think it was about a 70-page decision. Whistleblowers' rights are not strictly like a union issue, but they have always appealed to me personally and professionally as crucial to government working well, protecting whistleblowers. So I was involved in the 94 Whistleblower Reform Act, got that rewritten. It seems like every time we've rewritten the whistleblower protections in law, the Federal Circuit has come back and interpret them in such a way that we've had to go back. And as we speak, you know, there are bills in Congress to, again, reform the whistleblower protections, which are very needed. So that to me was a great achievement for me. Another one was in a case called Colorado Nurses, not an AFG case. The D.C. Circuit said registered nurses and doctors in the VA have no labor law, because their law said, notwithstanding any other law, the head of the VA can set working conditions. At a time when George Bush had 90% popularity, I negotiated a pretty decent labor law for Title 38 employees that's been running up in effect to this day. And not, you know, in there you're talking about tens of thousands of employees' rights. Same with the Smithsonian. They were viewed by the D.C. Circuit as a trust and therefore not under civil service or due process or labor law. I negotiated with the vice president, Connie Newman, of the Smithsonian, who was a very wonderful woman, a Bush appointee, Bush one, a believer in government, and she felt, yeah, we've got to get EEO rights and labor law rights to these employees. It's not right. So we negotiated that. So that was the only labor law reform in the 1990s.
Well, as we talk about the 90s and keep moving forward, the Clinton era and the partnership era, you played a really key role in that.
I am so proud of those years. I know all the Neanderthal management types are like, oh, Clinton just gave everything away to the unions. I would like to see any evidence of that. You know, it's like I feel we fought for everything that we achieved, and I am very proud of my participation in the National Performance Review and the section on human resources and labor management, my work in a small task force of putting together recommendations to the National Performance Review, and then my work helping to draft, along with the White House and some other unions, the Clinton Executive Order on Partnership, and then the OPM guidance on it. And where it was tried in good faith by both sides, to me, that partnership was the greatest reform of government that has ever been achieved. And that's even though only about 30% of agencies went into it with good faith. But you tell me another government reform movement, Grace Commission, management by budget, NSPS, and whatever you want to call them, they've all failed miserably because they've never had any effect on the shop floor. They've all just compiled dust. We made big differences on how agencies delivered their services, and some agencies in independent surveys were rated higher. The Mint, we came up with the idea for the quarters and the states, and as you know, that was incredibly popular, and the Mint was rated second to Mercedes-Benz as the best in customer service. The SSA teleservice hotline was rated ahead of Disney and Nordstrom's on customer satisfaction. So we accomplished a tremendous amount, but it shook up management too much. When Bush came in, the managers wanted their pound of flesh, and regrettably, we went through 8 years of hostility and fighting and preservation of rights.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with soon-to-be former General Counsel Mark Roth, discussing his 35 years with AFGE and kind of looking back on things. We were getting up to this decade, I guess, or the last decade. NSPS, that occupied a lot of your time over the past 7, 8, 9 years, I guess.
The Bush administration came in with very clear views about unions, and a lot of working papers from the Heritage Foundation on how you couldn't actually just go in and bust unions. So what you had to do was take away their ability to be effective at the workplace, reduce their rights, reduce civil service due process for all employees, not just union employees. I mean, this fight was bigger than unions. This was a fight for all federal employees. They started out in Homeland Security, in my view, shamefully taking advantage of 9/11. And I say shamefully, and I will say it until the cows come home, because everyone who went into those burning buildings on 9/11 was a card-carrying union member, and they went into those buildings knowing they probably would not come out. And the EMTs, the firefighters, and the police were all union members in New York City. And to then turn it around and say there's some sort of inconsistency between our need for national security and employees' needs for collective bargaining and due process, to me, that's the legacy, the negative legacy of the Bush administration. It came first as Max HR in the Department of Homeland Security, along with a coalition of other unions that we helped lead. We got that overturned and then defunded. And then, of course, in Department of Defense, they came up with a Me Too strategy. Well, if Homeland Security's got it, we want it. That was a longer fight, involved a coalition of over 30 unions. I like to joke that George W. Bush did something that Mahatma Gandhi, Samuel Gompers, no one else could do. He unified the labor movement. That coalition was made up of AFL unions, Change to Win unions, and independent unions, and we worked like, you know, a finely tuned instrument. And we took them on. We won in court. We lost in court. The Congress changed. And bottom line, they got nothing. They got nothing. And it's because they came in and so overreached on everything. They couldn't just come in and try and improve one of the systems, the hiring system, the performance management system, the appeal system. They had to come into the, you know, with the attitude of seek and destroy. And I have a lot of actually fond memories of that fight. And of course, I'm very result-oriented, and the fond memories are because we won that fight. They had a funny act law they wanted to introduce if they had gotten these other two validated by Congress and the courts. And I think it was, I can't remember the name of it, but it was sort of like
Work for America.
Yeah, the Work for America, which I compared to their environmental law, which is, they had one called the Clear Sky Act, which was basically destroying all of the forests. So, but they were good.
And you know, as you look back on it, I mean, you think about the different times in this country and things that took place. I mean, I'm sure the 60s would have had a big influence on you and things that were going on back then. And that spirit that John Kennedy had of people coming to public service and that it was a noble thing. And what did it feel like to go through the Reagan years in particular, I guess, where they said government was the problem after all these people had given their lives and careers to trying to make the country better?
Well, you know, Ward, that actually started under President Jimmy Carter. He was really the first to come in and run against Washington and government. And my recollection, they all thought they were the smartest person in the room.
And you've been involved in a lot of the transitions as the administrations do change. Do you find anything that's kind of unique about that? I mean, you bring up that, you know, the people come in that maybe feel like they're the brightest people in the room, but don't have any experience in government. And do you think as they create more and more things about conflicts of interest and more things about you can't be a lobbyist and serve in government, you can't have advocated for somebody or a side that is involved in government, are you thinking we're starting to get people in there that might be very bright but don't know anything about what they're actually doing?
Well, you know, I think that really is a major problem. This idea that if you were a lobbyist or you work for somebody, you know, for a cause, should disqualify you from government, I don't know where they came up with this. Where would you find the people with expertise? I mean, if someone has worked for government causes in the private sector or nonprofit sector, and their views are consistent with your views as a president, why wouldn't you snap them up quicker than anything? On the other hand, I have had tremendous fun and tremendous fulfillment in working with President Clinton's folks and Obama's folks on appointments in transition times. And I'll tell you, I think AFG's been very effective. You look at our agencies, OPM, Federal Labor Relations Authority, MSPB, Department of Labor, we have got tremendous people in there that we recommended to them, the Federal Service Impasses Panel. And if you look at the Partnership for Public Services surveys, it shows that these agencies and how they're viewed by employees and their morale and their satisfaction and their effectiveness has skyrocketed. So I'm very proud of that. Again, it's not just a matter of union to me. Union is number one, because I think that's a means to an end. But for me, the end is good government. And, in all candor, it's been frustrating trying to show the value of what unions bring to good government as a check and balance on irrational and unilateral mismanagement.
And as you know, that we're talking to a lot of federal employees who listen into the show, whether they're members of AFG or not, what kinds of things do federal employees need to be worried about and be concerned about over the next couple of years, in your opinion, as a general counsel?
Well, the most pressing issue I see is this issue being argued now before the Merit Systems Protection Board, where AFG is the lead union representing the employees, and that is in this area of people designated sensitive non-critical. When you're sensitive non-critical, it's like you have no access to classified information and you don't have a security clearance. So what is the Department of Defense arguing? That you should have no MSPB or arbitration rights. If they find in their unilateral, irrational view that you are no longer qualified to serve in one of those positions, well, that's totally contrary to due process. And this is, you know, this is really a backdoor NSPS, because they're trying to get at the same thing, no rights. And now they're doing it for the people who are non-critical. We know that people that hold security clearances, you know, have limited rights. The Supreme Court has been very clear about that. But this extension is very upsetting to me, and we're talking literally 500,000 people. They could be in IRS, they could be in Social Security, not just military, Homeland Security. This is a scary thing. Continuing this idea that national security and collective bargaining and due process rights are somehow inconsistent. It just is not true. Ward, before we close out my segments of the show, I just want to say, number one, I have been blessed and privileged to have such a wonderful and long career. I love AFGE. It's been a great union. It is a great union. It's done so much good for federal employees. And I want to thank, you know, literally the thousands of AFGE activists, my AFGE family, for all their support. And in this process of my retirement, which has been kind of a long process so we could transition in a very smooth way, for all of their kind words and loving words, I just couldn't be more complete. I couldn't be happier. And I just want to wish everyone the best as the challenge of the Tea Party and those who are anti-government come to the forefront over the next decade.
Thank you to our guests this week, U.S. Election Assistance Commission Commissioner Gracia Hillman, AFGE 14th District National Vice President Dwight Bowman, Field Services and Education Department Director Bill Fletcher, and former General Counsel Mark Roth. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University.